Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Healthcare statistics on the broadcast today. Also, Wall Streeters take a rare day off. And a new series is going to start. We're calling it I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Monday, the 13th of January. Glad as always to have you with us, everybody. The semi-regular drip of statistics from the Department of Health and Human Services picked up this afternoon. The latest enrollment numbers for the Affordable Care Act are out. How many have signed up and who they are. 2.2 million people in all since October the 1st, 54% women, 46% men. Also, and this is the key number, a quarter of them are 18 to 34, the target demographic in a way. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein is on the story. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Kai.
It looks good, right? These numbers do, with 30% of enrollees under the age of 34. That's who we want in this thing, right? The young people. Is it actually as good as it seems, though?
Well, you know, look, that's a great question. It's all in the eye of the beholder, as you can imagine. You know, ideally, people want to see about 40% of the exchange customers in that age range. It's certainly better than some people had anticipated, that's for sure. But I think ultimately the question is, will we see more people show up in these final 11 weeks that they have to sign up before the March 31st deadline?
Is there a way to extrapolate premium levels and overall cost of this program based on these numbers today? Do we know?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Kaiser Family Foundation has put out sort of a mini report saying that if you end up with 30% of people in the exchanges being these sort of young invincibles, then it's not the end of the world. The sky is not going to fall. Here's Kaiser Vice President Larry Levitt. This is what he said to me.
Premiums might have to go up by 2 to 3% in 2015, but there's no risk of any kind of death spiral here with the kind of enrollment numbers they've released.
You know, look, Levitt says the worst case scenario rates are going to go up 2 to 3%, but not more than that. And, you know, he's optimistic. He thinks more young people are going to come.
The other part of this, though, Dan, is that another 30% of these people are 55 to 64. So it's about more than just age, right?
You're exactly right. I mean, a sick 23-year-old is going to cost an insurance company a lot more than a healthy 63-year-old. That said, though, Kai, let's not over-exaggerate this. The government plans to aggressively go out and really try to grab as many of these young, healthy people as they can.
What don't we know? What's not in these numbers, Dan?
You know, I was on this call today with all these reporters, and again, reporters were asking these questions, these very basic questions, like how many people who have signed up out of these 2.2 million people are actually the uninsured? How many of them are just switching over? You know, they had their plans canceled. Mm-hmm. We know that 3.9 million people have signed up for Medicaid, but how many of them are new? The projection is about 16, 17 million new people are going to be insured this year. But right now, we have no sense of how close or how far we are from that target. The final thing that we don't know that's pretty interesting to me is how many people are qualifying for this hardship exemption where they just don't have enough money to pay for it. So we're at a stage right now. It's early January. There's still a lot more weeks to go here. But we're definitely at a point where there are more questions than answers.
The mysteries of the ACA continue. Dan Gorenstein at the Health Desk for us. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, everybody. I will tell you what. Wall Street doesn't much care for 2014 at all. It will be the sad music when we get there. There's plenty yet to come in the political story of the past week or so. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and the George Washington Bridge traffic snafus, of course. The initial explanation for those jams was that it was all part of a traffic study. And in fact, at this very moment, you may well be in the middle of a traffic jam yourself. You may even unknowingly be in the middle of an actual traffic study. Somebody with a clipboard making a note of the achingly slow pace at which you pass by. If which, sorry to rub it in. Marketplace's David Weinberg has this study of the traffic study.
Traffic studies are kind of like the song Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison.
Do you remember when we used to sing?
I have a theory that at any given moment, this song is on the radio somewhere in America. The same is true of traffic studies, says Stephen Schrock.
There are studies that are going on constantly.
Schrock teaches civil engineering at the University of Kansas. There's a variety of reasons for doing them, and they vary greatly in cost. They can be as small as one person walking in a ditch along a rural road, measuring skid marks to determine the safety of curves.
And then the cost really just simply would be labor.
Or they can be massive studies involving cameras and devices that count cars. One thing studies have in common is that the main goal is to collect data.
Some people will refer to traffic studies as merely an observation of the way pedestrians, cyclists, and vehicles are interacting with the built environment.
David Hurwitz teaches civil engineering at Oregon State. As for the lane closure that occurred in New Jersey, it wasn't part of a traffic study. Those types of lane closures are very rare.
You typically would not reduce the capacity of a system, though. It's a, you know, this is a public good that we're trying to promote. We would want to increase travel times.
Data from traffic studies shows that the number of drivers and the length they are driving are both increasing. Meanwhile, the funding for transportation infrastructure has not kept up.
So then we're sort of stuck with what we have now, which is go out and try to study it and figure out, with what limited funding we have, what can we do?
Which, says Schrock, makes traffic studies even more important.
If you only get one opportunity to make an improvement, you want to maximize your chances that it's going to do the most good.
I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
The ban on tap water was lifted for a small, small chunk of West Virginia today, which means there is hope yet for the 300,000 people who were told not to wash, drink, cook, or basically do anything else with tap water after a chemical spill late last week. As promised, we've gotten back on the phone with Don Tate. He owns a chain of Fast Check supermarkets in and around Charleston, West Virginia, the capital city of that state. Mr. Tate, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Thank you, sir. Got a lot of feedback from your previous conversation.
Well, that's good. I'm glad folks are listening out there. Now, when we talked on Friday, you had gone through 480 cases of water in 28 minutes, I think you said.
That is about correct. They lined up for a block or two.
Now, I'm going to assume you restocked your supply. Did things go just as fast over the weekend?
Well, no. On Saturday afternoon, FEMA started shipping water into the valley, into the area.
Oh, that's good.
And all the fire stations, some of the churches were set up to give away water and that kind of thing. We still sold, we sold puddles of water. But the thing that happened was that all of our stores now are loaded. Probably each store has at least a trailer load of bottled water.
Wow.
Both in the half-liter bottles, which is, you know, about the soft drink size, and also in gallons. But they're expecting to get things so that tomorrow evening water can be shut back onto the homes. There's a procedure that you have to go through to drain your water tanks or your water lines and those kind of things to get out the contaminated water.
You had said that you were selling a lot of microwavable foods and paper plates and plastic forks. I imagine the shelves are bare there on that one, huh?
That is true. I think all stores, whether it's us or Kroger, the dollar stores, everyone sold out of the plastic knives, forks, and spoons, plates. I think it wiped it out.
You had said people were a little anxious on Friday. I imagine now they're just kind of grumpy, huh?
Well, it's a real inconvenience. There were a couple of motels right outside of this area that set up shower areas for people to come and take showers at no cost. My family and I went about 60 miles away, and we did four loads of laundry and took showers and those kind of things. But
did you get your hair washed, Mr. Tate? We were talking about that on Friday.
Finally did,
all
yes.
All right, good. What's been the worst thing about this for you, Mr. Tate?
Well, I think the worst thing of it was that we had to shut down our meat departments and our delis because there was no water to wash the utensils with, the saws, the slicers. Those are the things that we take for granted day in and day out.
Yep. Don Tate, he runs a chain of Fast Check supermarkets out in Charleston, West Virginia, where the water is slowly but surely coming back on. Mr. Tate, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to start a new thing today, a segment that takes your questions about strange little items in the world of business and commerce, things you've always wanted to know or could never quite figure out, and answers them. Like, how do gas stations know when to raise prices? When did wrapping paper become a thing? It's going to be called I've Always Wondered, and we'll do the first one to show you how it works, and then we're going to want your suggestions. Here you go. Here's the question of the moment. Why is it that almost every zipper has three little letters on it? YKK. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has the answer.
If you wonder.
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Next time you zip up or zip down, check out your zipper.
Huh. YKK. Wonder why it says that.
Good question, semi-dressed man. YKK zippers are everywhere. On my jeans fly, I just checked, likely on yours. So what's YKK? I head to Southgate, California to find out. Kuz Manufacturing, where they make AG jeans with YKK zippers. Yul Koo, the owner of the company, shows me around.
So how many pairs of jeans do you sew in a day here?
A little over 10,000.
10,000 pairs a day.
And it's a sight. Cutting, lasering. There are men here whose job it is to buff the butt of the jeans to make them soft. And at the very beginning of the process, people sewing zippers into the fly, adding sliders to the zipper chain. YKK zippers. Kuz used them for decades.
But one thing that we're starting to do YKK, then I never thought about someone else. That's the YKK is a good zipper.
A good zipper, says Kuz, doesn't break. You don't want a zipper ruining a $150 pair of jeans. YKK, it turns out, is a Japanese company. It's got about half the world's zipper business. Half. And they've got a zipper factory in Macon, Georgia, where I head next. Here in Macon, they make 5 million zippers a day. They melt copper, turn it to wire, make the zipper tape and tab and teeth, give the zipper a lock so it doesn't keep sliding down. There are a dozen or so steps in the production process. And at the end, voila.
So this is your standard blue jean zipper.
It's a good-looking zipper.
They make a whole lot of other zippers here.
You have molded injected products that are made out of acetyl or nylon resins.
Lee Smith is the VP of manufacturing operations. They make zippers in 9,500 colors, including 20 shades of black.
We have a number of zippers where somebody may be wearing a bomb suit or something and they want to get out of the zipper quick so that you can have a quick release.
Zipper R&D is a real job. Alex Gregory is CEO of YKK Corporation of America. He says these aren't easy days to be in the zipper industry.
It has really changed dramatically over the last 15 years as a lot of brand holders who were sewing product in first the United States and then Central America have started sourcing their products from all over the world.
Today, fasteners make up less than half of YKK sales. It also makes architectural products. But the zipper is still what YKK is known for, the humble zipper that keeps our pants up, our backpacks closed. Jervis Byron has made zippers at YKK for 38 years.
When you see your zippers on my boots or on my jeans or on your jeans, how do you feel when you see those zippers?
I feel proud. You know, I worked out to your friends. I worked there, you know, like that. Very proud of YKK.
I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We've got more facts about zippers and YKK on our website. We also know you have your own questions that you want us to answer. Look for the I've Always Wondered tab at marketplace.org to ask them. Coming up.
In the office at 8, home at 1 a.m. And, you know, on many instances, not home at all.
Wall Street and taking time off. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, Wall Street got clobbered today. That's the only way to say it. The Dow Industrial's down 179 points, 1%, closed at 16,257. The NASDAQ barreled down 61 points. About 1.5%, ended things at 41.13, while the S&P 500 stumbled 23 points, 1.25%, 18.19 at the close. The financial sector fell ahead of earnings reports from Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan tomorrow. J.P. Morgan shares fell 1.3%. Wells dropped 0.8%. Goldman Sachs ground down about 1.4% today. SodaStream belched 25% after it released poor earnings for the year. Come on, that's pretty good. And Lululemon dropped 16% after it said revenues will be down next quarter. Bond prices, why they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday.
In Washington, the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Courts, Intellectual Property, and the Internet discusses the scope of copyright protection. How did retail sales wrap up at the end of the year? The Commerce Department issues its monthly report for December, and maybe those retail numbers will reflect sales of pet clothing. Tomorrow is Dress Up Your Pet Day. My apologies to Fido. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The North American International Auto Show gets rolling today in Detroit. After a couple of years in which its future was very much in doubt, Detroit is back as one of the car industry's most important events. But in terms of actual car sales, you've got to go a pretty long ways from Detroit to find the world's hottest market. China set a record of number of cars sold last year, nearly 22 million, which made it the world's biggest market for 5 years running. Our correspondent in Shanghai, Rob Schmitz, has that story.
With so many new cars on the road, Chinese cities are threatening to limit the number of license plates they sell each year in order to ease traffic and air pollution. Some experts think this will mean a sharp decline for car sales in 2014. It actually means the opposite, says industry analyst Yale Zhang.
Several cities with this kind of rumors, the demand suddenly just jump up very quickly.
It's called panic buying, and Zhang says it's one reason auto sales in 2013 were so robust in China. Another reason is China's rural provinces, where millions are leaving their farms to become the newest members of the urban consumer class, and where there's still room to drive your car.
In those smaller cities, the traffic jam is still not very serious yet, so you still see a lot of room for demand growth.
As the rest of China slowly fills up with cars, roads in cities like Shanghai and Beijing have been bumper to bumper for years. People like Shanghai physical trainer Mo Yunsheng have sold their cars. Mo bought a Mini Cooper a couple of years ago as a gift for his wife for her hand in marriage.
I only bought it in order to get married. We never use it. It's easier to get around by subway.
But now Mo and his wife are planning to have a child, so he's thinking of buying a family-sized car. He's not sure if they'll ever use it. Maybe on the weekends, he says, when everyone else hops in their cars to leave the city, cramming the expressways with more traffic. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Data breaches and credit card hacking don't confine themselves to big box retailers, apparently. Neiman Marcus, the very upscale Neiman Marcus, has announced customers who used plastic at one of its stores during the holidays may have had their data compromised, as many as a million customers in point of fact. Neiman says it was told in mid-December about a possible data breach. Yes, mid-December, which brings us to this entirely obvious question. What took them so long to tell people? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith looked into that one.
Target waited 4 days to announce its data breach. Neiman Marcus waited a month.
They simply don't feel like they have enough information to come forward.
Independent reporter Brian Krebs broke the story. He says companies are using that time to figure out how many customers have been affected.
No company wants to be seen as, you know, trying to come out with a statement that they think they know how bad it is, and then it turns out it's a lot worse.
Kind of like Target, which initially said 40 million customers had potentially been affected. Now it's saying that's more like 110 million. Analyst Larry Poneman says PR is hugely important in a data breach, and the worse it's handled, the more customers a company will lose.
How many people will stop being your customer as a result of data loss or theft? And we find that it could be more than half of the total cost of a data breach.
But waiting for all the facts can trigger lawsuits and fines, says Ted Julian. He's with CO3 Systems, which helps companies manage data breaches.
There are substantial privacy breach disclosure requirements, and failure to meet those can trigger fines, which can add up quite substantially.
Julian says there are strict state and federal rules about how soon you have to report a data breach, and companies have to get smart about it quickly. All companies.
As people in our industry will tell you, it's not a question of whether or not you've breached. You have been. It's just whether or not you know it.
That's great. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
We've been running a series every once in a while called Disappearing Jobs. Jobs that, because the global economy is changing so much, just aren't around anymore. It used to be that in Mexico, sounds of the organ grinder could be heard everywhere. Nowadays, though, people are more interested in listening to songs on their iPhones than hearing them played on a hand-powered organ on a street corner. From Mexico City, the BBC's Will Grant reports.
Long before the arrival of television or radio, the people of Mexico City were entertained by the organ grinder. Treading the streets of the capital, the smartly uniformed men would turn the handles of their heavy wood and brass instruments in public squares. They used to be accompanied by a monkey, in whose hat the public would drop a handful of pesos. The monkeys vanished years ago, but now the organ grinder too is slowly disappearing. Don Odilon Jardines has been an organ grinder since he was just 7 years old. He has spent decades working in the neighborhoods of Mexico City and has paid for his children's education through the music.
I am an organist down to my bones. It's the only job I've known. I've been able to provide for my family so that all my children went to university. I am very proud.
Not only did Odilon make a decent living through organ grinding, he also passed the tradition on to his son-in-law, Roman Dici. Roman believes the vocation of organ grinder is being lost, as many young people entering the profession see it as just a more lucrative form of begging.
I'm at a series of traffic lights on the outskirts of Mexico City. While Roman plays, his son-in-law weaves in and out of the traffic to ask for a small contribution. Although this tradition remains, tastes have changed, and not everybody is prepared to stick their hand in their pocket to pay the organ grinder any longer.
Back in the city centre, 73-year-old Odilon Jardines, one of the oldest organ grinders still working on Mexico City's streets, says he'll continue to turn the handle on his instrument for as long as he's able. But if the organist's music is still going to be around for another 70 years, a new generation will need to show the same dedication that he has to the profession.
It can be tough getting back to work on a Monday after a nice weekend off. It can be even tougher getting up for work on a Monday if you don't get weekends off. That's kind of been the situation on Wall Street for a long, long time now, Saturdays and Sundays in the office. And that's why it was news Friday when Bank of America recommended its most junior people try really hard to take one day off every weekend, 4 days a month to be precise. Nancy Kane is a historian at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, it's good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, Kai.
You know, it feels like this story ought to have a slug that says not from the Onion, that Wall Street wants people to take, you know, at least 4 Sundays a month off. I mean, come on.
You know, you got to wonder what's behind this. Like, is this about cleaning up Wall Street's image?
Yeah.
Is this about portraying a kinder, gentler banking industry and culture? Is this about attracting talent, right? Because lots and lots of young, brilliant minds that also want to get rich, that would have in other times gone to Wall Street, now have this big other magnet on the West Coast, which is, I'm going to go work for a company and sell myself to Facebook. I will have my dog in my office, and I will have a big open kitchen, and the weather is a lot better in San Francisco than it is in New York.
And also, if you're on Wall Street making $75,000 or $80,000 a year, your first year out of college, but you're working 4,000 hours a year. That's like $15 an hour. I mean, it's, you know.
Exactly. And I can't tell you the number of students that I have had in my, you know, many years at the Harvard Business School who talk about, well, I'm making all this money, but, you know, on a per hourly basis, it's not that high. And P.S., when do I have time to spend it? You know, we're talking in the office at 8, home at 1 a.m. And, you know, on many instances, not home at all because you're working and drinking a lot of Starbucks.
Is this going to work? I mean, so Bank of America is doing this. J.P. Morgan is, you know, going to hire more junior people to lessen the workload. Goldman Sachs has a junior officer task force. Is it going to change that culture, you think, or is it just, you know, going to be?
I think it's going to take a lot more to change this culture that's so deeply rooted. And that means it's going to take some real creative destruction. This is not blowing it up. But P.S., you can bet all those folks, whether they take the Sunday off or not, are going to be logged into their smartphone, answering every single email that comes their way.
It'll be interesting to see in, I don't know, 5 years or whatever the appropriate time frame is, when the next list of managing directors at Goldman Sachs comes out. How many will have risen from analyst and actually, you know, not suffered for this?
Very interesting. And you think about other professions where the early years are so very difficult physically as well as, you know, intellectually or emotionally. Think about med school.
Well, right. That's what I was thinking of, yeah.
Right. So American medical schools are now looking at exactly the same issue. But again, until you blow it up and really start building something else, it's very, very hard to change this because it's been this way for a long time. Two is a lot of the people that now control it went through it. And three is there's always this question of, well, if I do this, if I actually take the guidance, will I, you know, subtly or less subtly have some kind of black mark by my name?
It's easy to believe there's somebody sitting there with a little tally book going, oh, this guy wasn't here on Sunday.
It's very easy to believe that. Yeah. And people do, especially in such a hierarchical kind of industry like the banking industry.
Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, about which there is not much more to say than how lame is this? The San Francisco Chronicle is reporting today that the Seattle Seahawks, against whom the Chronicle's hometown 49ers will kick off for the NFC Championship this weekend, won't sell tickets to the game to anybody using a credit card with a California address. Only credit card using residents of Oregon, Washington, Montana, Idaho, Alaska, and Hawaii will be tolerated at CenturyLink Field, apparently, the Chronicle says. And yes, I get the whole home field advantage thing and everything, but still, lame. And I'm not even a Niners fan, by the way. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program for us. Have a great evening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.